Hey, everybody, this is Brad. Just wanted to give a fair warning because this is a podcast episode and not a radio episode. There could be some adult language. So if there's tiny ears or if it's something that you're concerned about, just fair warning to let you know. Other than that, enjoy the episode.
I'm a hardhead, always having a fit. When I'm not loud to tear up shit, I'm a hard motherfucker. Too hard, motherfucker.
This is Local Mash, the podcast. I'm Brad Lyons with Van Gunner.
Hey!
And special guest tonight, Stella Biscuit.
Oh!
She's a canine with one eye.
There we go.
There's the jingle bells, the Stella Biscuit bells.
Now, do you know the secret why we have three cat bells on this puppy?
No, I was wondering that.
It started out as one, just as, you know, when you're in the kitchen and you might not hear a pup creep.
Is it a milestone thing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's really? A milestone, yeah. So when she became a food thief, I mean a hardcore food thief, we put two bells.
She's brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She learned how to walk and sneak around and crawl and not rattle the two bells. So now we had to attach a third bell.
Yeah. I think, Biscuit, I didn't think about this till just now. So for context, everybody, Van and I have been best friends since seventh grade.
Yeah.
We were talking about this earlier. It's literally been 30 years of friendship.
Yeah.
You know what we didn't do? Like a...
What?
A birthday.
I know.
A birthday friendship thing.
We're going to have to figure that out.
Oh. What was I just... Oh. This dog that is sitting in front of us is brutal because Stella Biscuit, her little partner at home, Izzy, basically has like a half a back leg.
Yeah.
Right?
Like she's a wobbler.
She's a wobbler. And this little shit just blatantly steals Izzy's food.
Yeah. She is if this was...
What's going on here?
If this was prison sentence, I mean, she would have 30 to 35 years behind bars.
Although, weren't we all kind of like that in college?
Well, I was very protective of Hamburger Helper.
You were.
So you didn't take any of that from me, but yeah.
But there's those people.
Yeah, yeah.
That will absolutely take your shit.
Yeah, your peanut butter. That's the greatest offense for me.
Oh, yeah.
Don't touch the peanut butter.
Well, are you... Creamy,
yeah,
crunchy.
Dude, creamy Jif.
Man, I'm extra crunchy.
See, you never touch my peanut butter.
I don't want it. But here's the deal. It's a lesson for life, right? The people that will steal your food in college, that's kind of it's going to map onto other parts of their life as they get older, right?
They will steal your Blu-rays as adults.
Yeah.
Huh?
There you go.
Okay.
So we're talking Blu-rays as adults.
Sorry.
What's the age range for adult? What are we talking here when we say adult?
Age range of adult, let's go, let's say 25.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just throwing 25 out there.
Starting at 25?
Yeah.
So 25 to 35?
Yeah.
If you're stealing Blu-rays.
Yeah.
What about Laserdisc? You can't just walk out
with a Laserdisc. If you're stealing Laserdisc, you are elderly.
Does anyone listening to this right now, if they're still listening at this point, remember Laserdiscs?
That sounded like a no.
Yeah.
I wonder how many... So the things that have come back since we've had vinyl, some people who I personally would have to deem as crazy lunatics are getting back into analog cassette tape.
Yep. It's a little thing right now.
Nobody's diving back into Blu-ray. Or do we have some Blu-ray players out there? I mean, some people who are
there's a lot of Blu-rays going on out there.
I hope there's not a Facebook group of Blu-ray users. I mean, I'm sorry, Laserdisc. A Facebook group of Laserdisc users and collectors and players.
I would almost guarantee you that on Facebook that exists.
I'm too afraid to check.
You should be.
Because what if we found out that it wasn't like 120 people, but it was like 250,000 people in your area are Laserdisc users.
And for those of you that don't know what a Laserdisc is, this is kind of, you know, it was competing technology. DVD and Laserdisc came out at Laserdisc was a little bit earlier, right?
Yeah.
But you're talking about discs bigger.
Way bigger than a
vinyl record.
Yeah.
It was like a comically large CD, almost like a pop, like a prop for SNL or something.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculous.
Shiny.
Super shiny. Couldn't scratch them up.
Mm-mm. And you want to talk about taking up real estate? You know, when you think about your record collection, but you think about a laser disc, because those things were heavy too.
Yeah.
I mean, if you dropped one, if you were to drop it, you know, with the edge down on your pinky toe,
right,
it could break it. You're not going to break your toe from a vinyl record, but a laser disc could break
your
toe.
Is that your metric?
Yeah.
Does it break a toe? Could that break a toe?
Then that's bread.
DVD?
Nah. That ain't going to break a toe.
Laser disc?
Mm-hmm.
Eight-track?
Eight-track could chip a nail.
At least.
It would totally chip a nail. Break a toe, I don't know. Laser disc, it's going to break a toe.
Man, I'm really happy that we provided some overdue content for our laser disc user listeners.
I'm more thrilled with the fact that the new Early James, what are their names? Early James and what?
Well, that's funny. I feel like an idiot, maybe. I shouldn't feel like an idiot.
I wouldn't go that far.
I remember them as Early James and the Latest. I think this new record is just billed as Early James.
Okay.
So
I didn't want to go too
far. Yeah, totally.
I'm thrilled that the new Early James album is not an album. It is the new Early James Laserdisc with bonus features.
Yeah, he's putting it out on everything.
Yeah, laser. I mean, that is a pioneer who has gone back to the true form.
Yeah, he's saying, I'm not just going to bring back one thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring back every antiquated medium.
And it's not even just the laser disc if I were to drop it on my toe, but if I was to drop any track from this record on my toe, it would break. Boom!
He even put it out on Victrola.
Oh! He's going that diamond head tip kind of, okay.
No, it's a great record.
It is my springtime record, man. Just hearing the first few tracks on it and then diving into it, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird, man. It's like a good weird. It's groovy, but not boring. It's heavy without being... It kind of covers a lot of ground, the record does. But it was just a two-piece at the beginning. And now you got some incredible players. Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys produced it. And I said this in the radio show, but that's really cool that he did that. You know what I mean? That they got to work with him, but it's just a good record.
Yeah.
It's not a gimmick thing. We're like, if you like the Black Keys, then it's not like that.
No. I mean, we've been playing it around the studio, and it is one of those that people walk down the hall. Who is that? What are you wearing?
Totally.
It's a great record.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to James and Adrian in more detail about all that kind of stuff. So I guess we should go ahead and do that now that Stella Biscuit is
on the chair. Yeah, it is as if she has taken her doggy meds.
It's our calming voices.
Yes. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hearing more.
Yes.
From Early James.
Until then, we're going to listen to Blue Pill Blues, the first track on the new record from Early James. It's called Singing for My Supper. And then you're going to listen to my conversation with James and Adrian. And I'll talk to you afterwards. Bye, Van.
Oh, yes, bye, Brad.
Bye, Biscuit. Just can't lose these bruises.
and my skull. What I'm cutting back is only quicker to attack. Chip on my shoulder, chip off the old block. Pulling all the strings, I'm just a puppet sock.
So we already talked a little bit about the record, but just for people that might not have heard everything, I don't want to, you know, rehash all of it, but guys are on tour right now. We had to record this before they went on tour because they won't be back before the album came out. So where do you guys know where you guys are going to be right now?
Yes. Oh, wait, or right, like right the second?
Around the 13th?
Yes.
Where are you guys going to be?
We will be at the Fillmore.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, man, I'm super pumped about that. That's one of my favorite venues, and only from like records and stuff that I've heard. Never seen it, never been there. Super excited to be actually in there.
Dude, that's one of the most fun things about touring is getting to play rooms that you grew up like listening to records from or, you know, getting bootlegs from
or whatever.
Weird. Dude, it's crazy to be on some of those stages. What have you guys played so far that's been a place, or is there a place where you're like, holy shit, this is cool that I'm playing here right now?
Man, I think this last, like the second to the last day we did with Marcus King, this last run was at the Fonda in LA.
Yeah,
that
was cool.
And like, I don't know anything about that venue, but it was like right there on Hollywood Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And so it felt super LA. It was just, I don't know, it felt really cool.
Yeah.
And then, the old Greta Van Fleet dudes came.
Yeah, what's bad mouth those guys? Like,
they were shit faced, man. Oh, they're like 3.5 feet tall. They're tiny.
Yeah, are you serious?
They're super tiny, man.
Why are all famous people super short?
Well, these guys are children.
That's true.
They're young. That's true. They're little babies. And man, they were just mooning everybody, and it was great.
It was just kind of an out of body experience for me because I was just trying to like buddy with Marcus, and like they were just, I don't know, I guess when you play SNL, you just start mooning people.
Yeah That's what I hear. That happens a lot.
Just that whole instance just felt so LA to me, and I felt very, very I felt like a fly on the wall at a cool LA party. Yeah. And it was fun, man. Just some rock and roll band that is just young Led Zeppelin just comes sticking their butt everywhere.
Man,
Will Zeppelin.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got to be honest with you, man. I can't take it. Because, I mean, Zeppelin, especially with my age or whatever, it was like, I guess that doesn't even matter. Zeppelin was like why I really fell in love with music and rock and roll when I was a kid. Yeah. You know what I mean? And to hear them, I'm just like,
I mean, in their defense, though, that's probably the reason they wanted to play music too.
And absolutely,
You know, you sound like the stuff you listen to. Mm-hmm. I particularly early on, I think James was always worried about folks thinking he sounded like the people he was listening to, and some people do think it, and that's fine. But
right,
I think James is pretty original. Like his voice is pretty original, but
well, that's my point. I'm not like I'm not trying to shit on that band, but they're so close.
Yeah,
they're also very talented. So
they
like,
are super talented. It's confusing.
We can at least say they're talented, yes. Not completely, you know, dog them.
Yes,
but no, like either the guitar player or the I didn't talk to them, but somebody told me that night that and maybe it was just a drunk bit. But the dude's from Michigan and was talking with a British accent. Like, I'm just like,
really?
Wow. I hope it was just a drunk bit and they were like,
I hope. I'm going to pretend that's what it was.
pulling the ultimate troll, like, and just
they're just laughing at us.
They have a new album about to come out, and we're like, holy shit, where did this come from? It's just like
completely different. Yeah. So let's talk more about the record, because there's what I'm surprised by is that you're talking about with the band. It was only 2 days in the studio with a band.
Yeah, let me tell you who the band was.
Okay, cool.
So Billy Sanford, that's the dude who came up with the Pretty Woman guitar lick. Russ Paul, Dave Rowe, that was Johnny Cash's bass player. Mike Rojas, he was probably he played accordion, played every version of a piano.
Right.
And played some of the coolest, like there's one part, the lyric is, she's a leech on a leash, I can't shake her off, and he kicks the piano. Just, nobody asked him to, and it was just like, whoa, that was cool.
Yeah.
And he never does it again. And Sam Baca, that's the Nashville Symphony percussionist. Paul Franklin is like one of the most famous pedal steel players in the world.
Definitely know his name.
And then Gene Crispin, like Elvis's drummer.
Damn, dude. And these are just people that Dan knows, or how did that even come about?
They didn't even really have, the cool part about it is they didn't really have gigs. They were just session guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wanted to build a team when he started the Easy Eye, and they just all meshed together. And he won't let anyone, like, he just gets solo artists. He doesn't let, like, Marcus King Band, they're totally, you know, tight. They've been playing since he was 16, so
right.
Like 2013. But he was still like, nah, man, like, Marcus, you just come in. And
interesting.
Their band was pissed, just like Adrian was, but
right.
Also
pissed.
you're a little upset at first, but
it's upsetting.
It worked out like it worked out great, and we had to, there was no version of me that was like, I'm gonna turn this down.
Right. Well, how did it come about?
Just
how did that whole thing happen with meeting Dan? Did you meet him?
Yeah.
Or
Ryan Saab, when he moved to Nashville, ran into Katie Pruitt's manager, and then Ryan just showed him a YouTube video of me and Adrian.
Oh, wow.
And Clay had to go up there to EZI.
Clay's Katie's manager.
Okay. Yeah. And Clay Bradley had to go up there and meet with Dan because he was representing Kendall Marvel at the time, and Kendall was doing a record with Dan.
Okay.
And while he was up there, he's like, hey, check out this dude. I don't even know him yet, but we've been emailing, or like, I think Instagram, like
messaging. Or something. Yeah.
And Dan was like, I didn't even know Clay. Like, I didn't know who he was or like what he did. I didn't know in what capacity he was trying to contact me. And then all of a sudden, he was like, well, I got you a meeting with Dan Auerbach. I thought it was completely full of shit.
Bullshit,
I remember calling Adrian and calling my booking agent and, like, calling – I called, like, Paul Janeway just to be like, do you know this guy? Like, just calling anyone that is kind of on another level that might know who this guy is. And they were just like, just drive up there. Just see what happens.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I'd, like, follow the address, and it's like this – weird background studio that's behind.
Don't tell them where it is.
Like a, it's behind like a flower shop.
Gotcha.
It's got barbed wire everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of Cadillacs parked.
Really?
And I just walk in and Dan's just getting stoned, and I shake his hand. And it's, oh, this is real. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I understand your skepticism at first, like calling people like, is this bullshit?
Is he going to steal my
more
organs?
More times than not, it's usually bullshit, right? Like, if you've been doing music long enough, you've fallen into someone's trap at least once.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, I should totally pay this person X amount of dollars for this whatever when, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. But that's cool to hear that it actually happened in a really kind of, like, natural way.
Yeah, kind of a Birmingham way. Like,
yeah.
If that's the only thing Ryan Saab accomplishes by moving to Nashville was my success.
Right.
He's gonna hate me for that one.
No, he's. I mean, he just. I mean, I know this isn't coming out till later, but he just put his stuff out.
Yeah, man, it sounds great.
I love it.
I just. Dude,
we just saw him two nights ago.
Yeah, and his band is so tight. Yeah, it sounds so good.
Man, he's like he's finally gotten into a good groove that I think fits like his roots and his personality.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he was playing a lot here, he was doing a lot more acoustic stuff.
Yep.
Which I really loved, but you know his background is. You know, playing in rock bands.
Yeah.
And so now he's playing his same songs that are still lyrically heavy and
right.
still strong, but with a power trio.
Yeah.
And it rocks,
yeah.
man. It's so good.
It reminds me of, and not in a, you know, shitty ripoff way, it reminds me of The Replacements. That's, and I think that's perfect.
That's his favorite
that's
great, band.
Man. Yeah, I mean,
right. Yeah.
It's rock and roll, and it's still like, it still has like sensitive moments and mm-hmm. stuff. And there's like moments where, you know, the band's rocking and he's just like not strumming his guitar anymore. And it just like, it feels so heavy.
Yeah.
But like, it gives him some moment to like let the lyrics breathe and stuff. And I don't know. He's on a good swing right now.
Yeah. It seems like it. Seems like he's happy. Yes. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he seems happy.
Man, it's not often that people are happy playing music. like the reality is, I mean, you're happy when you play music,
right.
but there's a lot of dead moments that just really kick you in the face.
Most of the time is just some form of waiting for that moment to happen again.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, I always feel like it's some sort of part of my addict personality in a way is like that. I don't know if it's the dopamine hit or it's just the. When something's that moment happens musically,
yeah,
you know, whether it's a great show or a great session or, you know, you got together to write with someone or on your own and something great came out, but those don't happen all the time. You know what I mean? It's like you guys coming in, you recorded 18 songs for a 10 song record, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean those 8 songs suck.
No, there's several that I wanted to be on there that weren't.
So. Sure. I feel like that's. We're all just like chasing that thing constantly.
That yeah, I mean, that's like that moment you get off from playing and then like, you know, you get home and, you know, you're not going to go to sleep.
Hell no.
And so you're like trying to figure out just like, what dumb cat video can I watch that can just like recenter my brain?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's the nice part of like playing live. Like having cool records and stuff to listen to is great, but like going to see a band play or being the band that's playing, like being in that room is like a fun thing that you get to do and share.
Right. What's some of the stuff that, I don't know, artists around town, bands around town that you guys are really into right now?
Man, I really have been enjoying the Sara Lee Langford record.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's a great record.
It's really great. And Ford's playing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like that's one band that he said that he like he said if he could play with her for the rest of his life he would be okay.
That's cool.
Like and then that's and she's such a good songwriter. I know she doesn't play live a whole lot,
mm-hmm.
But I think that that's like a good. It's got a good Birmingham sound to it.
Yeah,
and I like that a lot.
Well, that's the cool thing about the record since she doesn't play a ton is that it's such a live sounding record that you kind of get. That is the experience. It's like listening to an old Dylan record or something like
yeah,
that. You know what I mean? Just it, and I know much more went into it, but it gives the vibe of someone just threw some mics up with some musicians in a room and there were these great songs and they just did it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems real effortless and simple in a really great way, you know?
Yeah, I dig, they don't have any recordings yet, but, Wave the Ocean.
I haven't heard him.
It's
Ben Ayers.
It's just Ben Ayers from Yellow Dandies,
uh-huh.
who is, you know, well, it's always uncomfortable, but still more so uncomfortable because he just like bought a deluxe reverb and is playing a Telecaster, but he's like a flat picker.
Oh, really?
He plays everything, but uh-huh. he's mostly like just a like hot shot. Bluegrass flat picker.
Man.
And so like his and he writes these weird songs on the side and plays them acoustically, but now it's AJ Covey and Ryan Brown and it's just a trio and it's just instantly I was like, oh man, this is like my favorite thing now because it's weird.
I want to hear that.
Because it reminded me of myself, because, and that sounds egotistical, but like seeing him kind of floundering, because that felt like I did that. Like I was so comfortable. Like I'll be Mr. Acoustic Guitar and be very comfortable, not have to have an amp or a pedal board or even be in tune sometimes.
That hasn't changed.
And like it was nice to like see him up there doing like, because I think Ben writes some of the most original songs in town. Like they're not bluegrass at all.
Right.
But because he plays in a bluegrass unit format, they of course are going to sound bluegrass.
Sure.
But that, and I can't stop listening to Taylor Hollingsworth, the Tap Dance.
Oh man.
Yeah, man.
We wore that one out on the road.
That's another guy. I got to add another one to my list. I got to say it on air, but I was fanboying over James over here, watching him play guitar at that Music Behem Christmas party for everyone. And I had one of those moments that I have every once in a while, which is I see someone play guitar that's really great, and I go, well, I should probably quit playing guitar. But what happens is by the time I get home, I think also after seeing you play that night, I think I had a guitar on me constantly for about a week, which is a good thing. Yes, you know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, it's like, I want to get better. But it's you, Jody Nelson, Will Stewart, and Taylor Hollingsworth. Like the cool thing, all those players are completely different stylistically and where they come from and all that kind of stuff. But one thing that I feel that's really important, or I think is really important when I see someone play, is that kind of, I don't know, it's pretend the music's just floating around up above our heads kind of thing, which I don't necessarily believe that, but just for the analogy, and the people that are able to, in that moment, just let it kind of like pass through them without a lot of thought or filtering.
Yeah.
It just feels really pure, and all, you know, you and those other guitar players, that's what I get, especially seeing all those people live. It's just like, man, it's beautiful and it's interesting and it's, and Taylor, like on paper, I shouldn't like his voice. His voice should drive me crazy.
I love his voice.
I love it.
It's fantastic.
You know?
The whole thing he does is so perfect.
Been good. I wish I could do it.
We should work on, little caricature imitations of his voice.
Yeah, man. Red Harp. God, if I would have remembered his name, the guy from Red Harp.
Garrett.
Garrett does the most unbelievable. To the point of like making Kate mad. Like,
really?
Kate's like, quit.
Stop. You're freaking me out. talking about like listening to other people, for both of you guys, you've been playing for a little bit longer and you're a little bit more seasoned. What influences do you hear in your own playing? For each of you guys, you know, because there's stuff that I listen to a lot of, but I can't say you hear it in my playing. And then there's some stuff that I listen to tons of, and you can totally hear it in my playing. You know what I mean?
I think about that a lot, just because I play bass.
Right.
I poke around on guitar, but I'm not anywhere close to being a guitar player. And so the stuff I listen to, I'm not listening to because I like the bass.
Mm-hmm.
And I also... The stuff that you would listen to because you like bass, I don't really enjoy listening to that much.
Yeah,
I think like listening to, you know, some really cool Victor Wooten album is fantastic, and his talent is unmatched. But I don't want to listen to that. I just don't. I want to listen to like a song. I like songs more than I like pieces of music.
Yeah.
And so the stuff I'm listening to, I'm trying to consciously listen to more female writers.
Mm.
It's just kind of where I am because there's so many good ones, particularly in town, but even just around. And I think that like last year, and I'm going to say probably this year too, is going to be a good year for people to pay attention to some female writers.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm trying to listen to. And on a lot of those records, I don't know who's playing bass, don't necessarily care. So I'm trying to think of my playing as just being something that just serves the music.
Yeah.
And then
those are the best players.
Yeah.
Like, I love that answer because
I'm the same way. I never learned an instrument to be, you know, I didn't pick up guitar and be like, I want to be Steve Vai. Yeah. It was, I picked up the guitar and was like, I want to be the electric Jimmy Page and the acoustic Jimmy Page. And because of Jimmy Page, I wish I could play like Robert Johnson and Son House. And you know what I mean? Like those people. But it's still all about the song.
Yeah.
Again, you know what I mean? I just want to learn instruments because I love songs.
Well, that's, I mean, I think that's the crux of the whole thing. Like, Jimmy Page didn't set out to be Jimmy Page.
Right.
So, like, when you, like, are more of a song man instead of like, I want to do that Steve Vai thing.
Right.
But like, I'm sure Jimmy Page listened to not only other guitar players, but it was just probably into like the, well, he was probably just fucked up when he pulled that bow out. But like, he was listening to other instruments. Just like, I mean, like, I'm not even a Deadhead, but, and I can't even remember his name.
Jerry Garcia?
Jerry Garcia.
Wow.
Was obsessed. apparently he was obsessed with horns more so, just like Hendrix was obsessed with horns. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know.
Yeah, I think like for soloing, listening to horn players that only get one note at a time.
Right.
Yeah, that's it makes sustain.
You, yeah, it makes you think like, about the note in a different way.
Yeah. There's this really important moment I had I'd only been in Nashville for probably maybe a year or something like that. And at that time, 12th and Porter, which I don't even know if it exists anymore in Nashville, to be honest with you. But at that time was a real great spot for Daniel Tajan who's an amazing guitar player. If you don't know, he is great guitar player, great songwriter. He co-produced that last Casey Musgraves record, actually.
Oh, okay.
Him and another buddy of mine that I used to know up there, and it was crazy because it would be at that time like Minnie Smith wasn't anybody yet, and she would come up every Monday night and play the two or three songs, and then I'd be up there playing with someone else, or it was just this cool thing. And at any given night, like, some really crazy people could walk through the door just to hang out and watch the people playing or whatever. And Joe Passapia, who we ended up being friends later down the road, but now he's a producer, still guitar player. He did the last Katie Lang record, actually, which I thought was crazy. Okay. And he went to go do a solo, and it was like a 16-bar thing, and I think he played three notes, and it like wrecked me. And I knew that I had moved to Nashville because there was just something I didn't have yet. You know what I mean? I knew that I could play, but I guess I hadn't found my own voice. Maybe that's what it was. And that night was like, that's what I have to figure out. I have to be able to play three notes and like wreck somebody emotionally in a good way in the crowd. That's what it's about. Not look what I can do. You know what I mean?
Going back to Ryan Sabat, he describes that same thing that you're talking about, just a really cool way of saying, like, you need to be able to play a riff because it's cool, not because it, like,
is impressive.
Impressive, yeah. Right. Like, a good riff should just, like, serve the music. Everything should serve the music. And, you know, if you're playing in, like, a fast rock band, like, fast riffs are cool. Like, that serves the music. But if you're playing in a song where, I mean, like, you have to think about the lyrics. You have to think about what the song is doing. Mm-hmm. And so from a musician standpoint, if it's not serving that, if it's only serving you, it's not serving the song.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the key to all of it. Well, how do you write? Like, what's your, I know that's such a shitty question, man. Okay, let me rephrase. I'm not going to ask that question. I'm going to ask this. Do you typically, does it typically start with guitar, lyrics?
Yeah, for what? Sure. A lot of the time, I would just jump out a window if anyone like unlocked my phone and looked at my dumb
voice memos
where it's just me driving and me going like, bah, 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 bah. And I was like, is that major or minor? Like, what is this? Right. I don't remember it.
Lots of blackmail in my voice memos, too. Absolutely, yeah.
But, like, it's always just like a little figment thing, and then And I'll have that, and I'll show it to Adrian, or just like they used to come faster, but then we like it was I didn't realize how many we had. And now they're all like recorded, and I'm like, well, shit, like we finished them, all my little ideas, and mm-hmm. But those were, you know, going back to high school,
sure,
that I carried with me, and now I'm like, I need to write more. But it starts out. Sometimes it'll be like I'll hear someone like say something and I'll just be like, I'll look it up and see if it's already a song.
Right.
Like I was watching True Detective and Matthew McConaughey's character, Rust, says, at least I'm not racing to a red light. And I was like, oh man, is that a song?
Right. Yeah.
Like I didn't even have to really know what it meant, but like,
but it just kind of, like,
yeah, was like, spark. That comes out. And then I had a riff and that I already had. And like, that's the newest song I'm trying to write, a song called, and I was like, and then I heard somebody like, just like stupid things like Snowball Salesman. I was like, oh, that's a fun thing, because it's something that won't last, but you're still selling it, like,
right.
But it's starting to start lyrically, which is nice, because it was cool. Always almost always before a guitar thing.
So you're typically like trying to fit, did you do the like it's a guitar thing, and then you kind of have dummy lyric melody thing, and then you're trying to work out the dummy lyrics into real lyrics kind of, and now you're going the other way around.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
If I can at least start with, you know, the phrase where it's like, okay, there's a lot of, that's just one phrase, but it's enough of a phrase to evoke at least a couple of verses. Like, I think I know where I could start writing that, or right. where I could take that. Like,
it sounds like a stand-up comic to me because it's so observational, and I think that's cool. You know, like, I think one of the most liberating kind of like parts of the process for me is learning to be a songwriter, or which I still am. I'm not saying that like I know what's going on, but there's this guy, Bob Schneider, and he has this email song game, and it's every Sunday night he sends out a phrase or a word, and then you have until Saturday to write a song that contains that phrase or word, right? And it could just be anything, like anything. Yeah. It wasn't like, this should be a really inspiring phrase for you. And sometimes it was, but a lot of times it was like Snowball Salesman. It was just something ridiculous, you know? But learning how to not be so precious about every song that I wrote, which I was doing at the time, and just have fun with it, and just take a phrase, and if it doesn't speak to me, then record something ridiculous, because if you didn't get something in,
they kick
you out. Like, you have to submit something every week or you are out of the game. So you're getting to hear everyone else's songs too. But the point of all that was just to say that learning to have more fun with it and not be so dramatically overly important about songwriting. I love it. I think it's important. You know what I mean? But just to have fun with it. More inspiring stuff came out of me that way.
I need to read. Our buddy Abe Partridge he's a Mobile artist. And he was doing that, and me and Ryan Saab lived with each other. We were both doing it, and we would always wait until Sunday night, and just like
last second.
I'd hear him in his room, and we both got kicked out.
Yeah, I only lasted a couple months, man. I was like, I can't do it.
I'm gonna bring Ryan up again, and I'm keep doing it. He's like one of the most insightful humans,
just
in general. But like his idea of like writing songs is all about like work ethic, and mm-hmm. so like if you write just often and knowing that most of what you write is going to be trash,
right,
you're going to be your tool is going to be sharp, so that when like the good idea actually comes, you're ready and you know
you're
how
in shape.
Yeah, you're in shape. And like I'm not much of a writer myself, but I definitely understand that idea and that concept, mm-hmm. and I think that's a really good way of doing it. And I think that like something like that Bob Schneider the email game is great, because it's just a way, it's a method, it is a file to sharpen your tool on.
Yeah,
Well, and I realized, I mean, I didn't make it longer than 2 months, but I did get kicked out eventually. And I was fine with it. I just had too many other things going on, and I'm not a career songwriter. Like, for me, it was, I love doing it. I could get better. I could learn something from this kind of thing, you know? but hearing the other people's songs, too, and hearing other people not, you could hear the ones where it was like, oh, they just, it was Saturday at 11:55, and they just turned on their voice memo, said the thing over a cord, and sent it in, just so they didn't get kicked out, right. You know what I mean? But when you're doing that kind of thing, I realized, I looked back and I was like, okay, so just from the song game, I've written 52 songs this year.
Wow.
When you start thinking of it that way, but the thing is, like, what you guys were talking about, what you're talking about, Ryan's talking about, was that I was in shape, though. So I was knocking out the song a week from the phrase, but then it was always leading me to write at least another song that week, sometimes two. So then you think about 2 to 3 songs a week for 52 weeks.
Yeah, that's a ton of songs. Yeah.
And there's no way you're not going to get better after that year.
Yeah. And there's no way that there's not something worth using.
Absolutely.
So even if 90% of that's trash, that's... Mm-hmm. I mean, that still lives
with like
15 songs or something.
I still think the worst thing, and of course Bob Dylan said it because he was just trolling people from the beginning, but like he was just talking about like, I don't know, man, like if the song's not written within 15 minutes, it's just not going to happen. Like, and that's just a total lie. It's just a muscle. Like, and, but maybe it did. Maybe he is an anomaly. But he also wrote some really bad songs.
It's true. He's got a lot of content. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff that that it's so funny when I think there's a couple people like that, like Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen's like one of my favorites.
Yeah. But Bob Dylan's one of my favorites.
He's got a lot of shitty songs.
Yeah.
He's a great poet.
You can't be a fan unless you've just like the Beatles have a lot of bad songs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it goes back to that. Well, I've mentioned it on the show before in other conversations like this, but I'm probably messing the numbers up, but not too far. I remember reading I think it was a Quincy Jones article or interview where he talked about for a Michael Jackson record, you know, what, 10, 11 songs on the record, but they would record like close to 100.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds believable to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No matter what you think about him and all the other shit, like just from a musical standpoint and that kind of obsession and work ethic. Do you feel like you're a part of what makes it work for you guys as musicians and writers and all that is being a little bit obsessed? Do you feel like that's part of your talents?
A lot of it is just like once you have the first little taste like of success. I remember like the first time I played a show in Birmingham, it was like the Common House, the mm-hmm. old house show thing that Matt Waldrop ran.
Yeah.
He and his wife, girlfriend at the time. And, that was the first time I'd ever played to a quiet room.
Yeah.
I've just been in Troy, Alabama, or Luverne, like, playing peanut festivals. and way worse bars than the cool bars here in Birmingham. But that's where I got hooked. And John Prine has that quote about, like, everybody's always asking how you get in the music business, but nobody's ever told you how to get out.
Like, yeah. Yeah, that's like, true. Do you feel – how do you feel about – like, do you think you're going to be doing music for the rest of your life? Is this – for both of you guys, or is this?
I'm gonna do it till I don't want to do it.
Yeah,
because that's the moment that you shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah,
and I definitely want to be doing it right now. I had a job before this, and I, you know, am in a position where maybe I can have a job after this. So, mm-hmm. if I don't want to do it, it's not gonna serve.
You're not stuck with it.
Yeah, well, it's not gonna tell. It's not good for anybody. A jaded musician is the worst.
Yeah,
it's the absolute worst, man. Like. At that point, if you have to play, it's not because you like have something in you that has to play, but you have to play because you have no other skill set.
Right.
Man, that's sadder than somebody who just like is happy behind a fryer, man. Like,
sure.
I don't know. I mean, if you're going to be miserable, might as well make some decent money doing it because, you know, the music, playing music is not a job you get into to make a lot of money.
Mm-mm.
It's a job you, like, the its value is kind of unquantifiable.
Sure. It's hard to, I don't know. It's hard to walk that line. I just feel like I just have too much energy for music. It's like I don't,
yeah.
It's almost like I don't have time to have another quote unquote job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, no, that's, and I absolutely, like, I don't say that.
I don't mean that like I'm so busy as far as like, I just mean there's always something to do. Like,
yeah.
If I'm not booked that day and I'm in here, I'm doing something.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, I wasn't doing anything else. So coming here to talk about music is funner than, yeah. you know, not coming in to talk about
yeah,
music.
Right.
I think I get on people's nerves. Like I'm probably going to ask Cam Bagby if I can play guitar like tonight at Marty's.
But, right.
Or like every Sunday Zach Austin plays and I don't even ask. Well, now we live with each other. So
oh, you do?
It's just like I show up with the guitar amp and I'm just like, you're not paying me.
Right.
Like the first few times I did it, he would give me like half the tips. But now he's like, dude, you just quit.
Get this back out.
But yeah, I definitely feel like I'll be doing, like, I like what Dan did. Like, Dan probably did get burnt out for mm-hmm. a while, and there was like a long hiatus. And during that hiatus, all he was doing was probably learning how to, well, they did their records in their house, but like
right.
he was probably becoming a better producer and engineer, mm-hmm. and that was like a whole new thing. He played hand drum on a small weird detail on that Earls of Leicester, uh-huh. Jerry Douglas, like Flats and Scruggs,
yeah.
Throwback group. On the newest record, I think Dan Auerbach plays hand drum on it. And I was like, why? And he was just like, because I can't play guitar like them.
Yeah.
And, so I like, if I want to learn how to play drums, and it's going to be a long time before anyone will let me play, or bass. Like, bass should be easy for me, but it's not, because I'm playing bass. I'm just not aware of it, and then when I have to think about it, I mess up. So,
yeah.
But Adrian won't let me play bass because
that might be a good thing.
It's taking his gigs. That's what he said.
You're a great bass player too, though. I like watching you play, man.
Well, that's very kind. There are like so many great bass players in this town.
There are, man. It's funny. There's a lot of great guitar players. I feel like I get hired more since I moved to Birmingham, which has been good for me to. I get hired more to play drums since I've been here than guitar. And not that there's a bunch of bad drummers here either, but
yeah.
it always seems to be the thing that someone's missing more often than not mm-hmm. is the drummer rather than the guitar player or even bass player.
Yeah, less. And this may come from some other like hard times, you know, internet article or something, but Les was saying, man, like if you, all you have to do is like, knock off two or three drummers and you've killed most of the bands in town.
It's true.
And it's I mean it's just true that like not that there aren't even a lot of drummers in town, but like particularly drums and bass, like I play with the same guys, like it's pretty incestuous.
Mm-hmm.
Like everyone's playing with everyone, which in like it when I say it sounds like it's just making like a very, you know, like flat music scene because
mm-hmm.
you don't get the variety that you would get in otherwise, but like I think I play very different when I play in other bands. Like when I play with Ham Bagby tonight,
sure,
it's not going to be anywhere close to the way I play with James.
Right.
It's going to be obnoxious and I'm going to play a bunch of notes and
we love you, Ham.
No, it's going to be, that's
right, that's what it needs.
I think
right?
Ham would exactly say that, like yeah. that it's about like just being in your face and like heavy and just playing a lot. Like I sure. like doing that. That's it's like a good outlet for me to play like that with him versus playing.
Also shows versatility as a player too.
Yeah, and if I don't get that chance, like it starts to flatten out my personal playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like because if I'm playing the same with every group, I can't do other things. Like I used to play a lot more jazz gigs, and I haven't been because I haven't been doing it, so right. like my walking bass line is a little dull
or rusty. Yeah.
Yeah, and and it makes me sad. Yeah. So, but like noticing that in myself means I know what to do when I'm practicing.
Work on. Yeah.
Yeah. And like having something to practice is better for your like self-awareness. Like I know what I need to work on gives you a chance to actually work on something.
Yeah.
Instead of just like practicing the same thing.
Sure.
Which isn't really practice. It's just noodling.
It's just repetition. Yeah. Yeah. How did you feel about, what did you learn from the recording process, do you think? Were you, now that it's all said and done and over and you look back on it, like, is there a couple of things that stick out in your head?
Yeah, one that just gets on my nerves is, like, no matter how old a song is, you're going to change it and then be upset that you didn't do it on the record.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like, that's, I think I kind of already knew that, but now even more so because more people are going to be listening to this. And, but you have to just get over that. And it, like, I think a lot of people, specifically in Birmingham, fall so in love with a little batch of songs, mm-hmm. and then they never, they record them time and time again, and it's never right.
Right.
And so, like, that's how I felt about the four songs on the EP years ago. I was like, well, we'll do those again, right? And, like,
probably not.
And no, we're not. Like, I tried to play them the other night at Little Italy's open mic and, like, couldn't remember the songs.
Yeah.
And, like, that's definitely a way to get better is just, like, get over that fact that, mm-hmm. that kind of it's better to be like, I mean, you like not a quantity over quality thing, but like have a consistency of quality. But I think sometimes it is better to worry more about just like knowing when it's like, okay, this is at least like the gut feeling. Like I feel good about this, but don't get so hung up on like it being perfect. I think.
Yeah.
Because the perfection is in the live playing,
right?
I think, or as close as it's going to get.
Well, it's about emoting and like that being the focus, right? I mean, because that's the thing that people are going to, especially in a live scenario, that's what they're going to sense and grab onto and latch onto.
Yeah.
Right? They don't give a shit if you played the E major instead of the E major 7.
Yeah,
they don't give a shit. They don't even notice.
And it's just like it's fun to just be like, that's a snapshot of what this band sounded like at that point. And then people aren't going to remember that. People are going to be like, I want to hear that song because I don't want to hear the record. Like I can go listen to the record. Yeah.
That's been the funnest part of playing with the new guys though is that like when we first so we got Ford Boswell and Joey Rudisell playing with us and. When we first started, the first goal was learn the songs as they are on the album. Like that was never supposed to be like the way they needed to be played. Mm-hmm. That's just
how they ended up on the record.
Yeah, that's how they ended up on the record. And that was a starting point. And so like as we've been playing them more with these guys, like they have a new life. Like they're changing a little bit, and I anticipate and hope that they will change more. Because like that's as an audience member, you don't need to hear the album song or the song as it lives on the album.
Yeah.
But like if it's too far off, then
they don't know what they're listening to.
Exactly. Right. But like, it's fine to change those things. But like you can still have the sentiment in there with like whatever you like feel like you need to play that moment, you know? Like, because that's part of playing to an audience, you know, particularly if you're playing to, like, a rowdier audience that they're not, you know, maybe listening in the way that you'd like them to, you know, make them be loud and crazy and, like, draw them back to you. Or if you're playing to, like, a more sensitive audience that's actually listening, you know, you can be... pull back in places where, where you need to be quiet, you can almost be silent and like make those loud moments more dramatic and do all these things.
Read the room.
Yeah, you can read the room. And the only way of doing that is just playing to more rooms.
Just doing it over and over again.
Yeah. This is going to be a a pleasantly busy year for us this year. So far, we've only booked like through May, and we've got like 65 shows. That's a lot for us, and you know, we're having to travel, and so.
God, you're going to learn so much too about these songs, and that, because that's the cool thing is sometimes the crowd helps you find a new way to enjoy a song too. You know what I mean? When you achieve that kind of like back and forth with a crowd, where it's an actual dialogue between the crowd and not just I'm going to stand here and you watch me play.
Yeah.
You know, when it's that give and take, that reciprocal kind of energy back and forth, it's cool to hear how, like you're talking about, like whether it's reading the room, whether it's a year from now and you guys are just fucking sick of playing the same songs and you got to find new ways to make them interesting. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing about that is that that shows artistry and craft and understanding and valuing the people that might be coming to your shows, because when you get sick of it, people that come to see your shows a lot, they're probably sick of it. Not sick of it, but you know what I'm saying? If there's a song that they've heard you play live three times and the fourth time, you know, after a year, and it's got a different vibe to it, that's exciting when I go see people and they do stuff like that, you know?
These shows coming up are almost all opening slots. Mm-hmm. Which means that, like from a practical point, all that means is, like, you have a very tight window, and so you play as many songs as you can fit in that tight window. It doesn't, like, lead you to, like, it doesn't give you a lot of freedom to open the songs up time-wise.
Sure.
So we're sticking to our, like, very tight time frame. So it's gonna be nice to, like, get to kind of learn how we're all playing together and how we can move that. But until we get like longer time frames, it's not a whole lot of, you know, manipulation we can do.
Sure.
Or maybe there is. That's for us to discover.
You'll
I don't know.
Figure that out, yeah. You know, we talked about reading the crowd, but it's also like reading where you are, I guess, in your career too, and being like, no, the best thing for us right now is we have, what are you guys doing, 30, 45? What are you
45.
Doing?
45.
45? Make this the most tight, fucking badass 45 minutes these people can possibly
and when we,
see.
So we're going to Canada, and I think we're going to do like a 25-minute set.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough set, man, because like by
the
time
you get warmed up.
Yeah, that's the time that we're like, that's the moment where it peaks. Maybe that's the best, like, you know, it peaks and then get off, and you know, if they didn't enjoy it, then
yeah. Because there's nothing worse than like seeing a band open, especially if you haven't heard them before. And at first, you're like, "Oh, this is cool," but by the time the opening slot's done, you're kind of going,
"Yeah."
And you know what I mean? It can be this weird fall off that happens if it's too much content.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the other thing is where, particularly playing with Marcus. His audience, it was mostly standing room venue, so what do you call
just
it?
Just like open floor.
Yeah, open floor. So if you wanted to get in the front, you had to get there early, which meant that his best fans were there to see you.
Interesting.
Which
That's
made
cool.
for a really great time because they were big music fans, or else they wouldn't have gotten there an hour before
early.
The show.
Yeah.
Not even before his show, like an hour before we got on. So, you know, we kind of had it working in our favor. Sure. You know, anytime you play with like a good fan base, that's only good for you.
Absolutely.
Like it's your set to mess up at that point, you know, so, you know, just kick ass and hopefully they'll, you know, become a new
respond,
fan of yours.
Yeah. You guys going to have merch out there?
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys go to the merch stand after the show or anything like that?
Well, right now, we don't get to travel with the merch person, so...
Oh, right.
Like, after the set, like, after our set, I pack my shit up and I haul ass to the merch table.
Mm.
And then, you know, whenever they're done packing their stuff up, they'll come meet me out there. But I think that, man, Patrick Sweeney was like the best example of this, and I think he's like one of the hardest working musicians around. He's been doing it for a long time and really knows how to show his fans that he's working hard.
Right.
And he runs his own merch. He's he always runs his own merch. Like he can bring other people to do it, but he wants to like say hey to everybody who wants to say hey to him after mm-hmm. a show. And that rocks, man.
Dude, I've seen it. It takes a special kind of personality to do that.
But he's got a great one for it, man.
I've been out there on the road with, you know, people selling, you know, 5,000 seat theater type venues or whatever, and the lead singer goes out to the merch table every night and will stand there for 2.5 hours and talk to every single person in that line and sign everything. And it's like, that's a lot of energy to come off stage yeah. and to be willing to just stand there and talk to a bunch of like 100 people for a couple hours.
It shows respect, though. I mean, absolutely. Like people that are willing to spend money to come see you, like, why not show them that you respect them back? But also, man, like the alternative is like meet and greets, mm-hmm. and the meet and greet is just like, who is willing to pay even more money to meet me? Like, meet everybody or meet no one. Like, I don't know. It seems weird to just like...
Some of that stuff can get kind of wonky and weird.
Yeah. I have a lot of feelings about that, which I don't know. I don't want to say too much because, you know, if maybe we're doing a meet and greet at some point, then I've talked myself into a corner.
Yeah. Well, so let's go back to the album real quick before we get out of here. So 10 songs... Like, it's funny that you mentioned, too, that you're like, I'm not really a Deadhead, but there's a couple songs. Is it track 3? Oh, I can't remember which one it was. I was like, oh, I hear some Grateful Dead vibes in here. But, and that's meant as a compliment. But
yeah,
I can't remember which song it was. I thought I had written a note on it. But also, I wanted to, because I love this song, Gone as a Ghost, the second to last song. Yeah. Talking about, like, the back half kind of being initially, like... I'm not used to hearing about that. That's one of my favorites. I love that song, man. So, which you guys have put out 2 singles as of this recording. What's that going to look like for, or do you guys know what it looks like for continuing to promote this record after it comes out? Is it just the touring? Do you guys have more singles that you're thinking
after
about?
After it comes out?
Yeah, after it comes out. Or around the time of release, I should say.
We'll have one more single and hopefully one more music video.
Cool.
And then we've had a really heavy touring after March on the record for probably the better part of the year, and maybe a little bit, and then hopefully get back to it and record a new album.
Yeah, man.
I don't want to sit on this too long because there's just so many more songs to that I want to play. We don't play one of the songs on the record, but then we add like 2 or 3 that aren't. Didn't even get recorded, like a couple of them are newer.
Just stuff that you're excited about right now?
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's pretty much the game plan for this year. It's just one more single, one more video, and then heavy touring.
Yeah. Well, I'm not just saying this. I really love the record.
Thank you, man.
And I love hearing you guys live anytime I can. It's always fun and inspiring and, I'm glad I live in the same cities as you guys.
We're not going anywhere.
Good deal. No.
And there will be a show in Birmingham in April, I believe.
Okay,
with
cool.
Lone Bellow at Saturn.
Oh,
So that'll be the next time folks can catch us here in town. So please come out to that. That'll be fun.
And we'll post some stuff on all the social media shit and all that stuff too. So, well, guys, thanks so much for real.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming out and hanging out all day on a Saturday. Appreciate it.
That's good. Thanks, Brad.
All right. Thanks.
She waits and
she waits, just hoping I'll take the bait. I guess I'm in season. I wait and I wait, hoping for a stalemate. Where did I go wrong? She's a leech on a leash. I just can't shake a hold. Each sip she takes, I'll just justify the lows. I swear the time before the last was the last straw. Now all that's left is the needle and blood to draw.
Batwell Studios Podcast Division. Your words, our expertise.